Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
I am Brandi Clark, and I'm a singer-songwriter who tells the truth. That's what I strive to do.
Let's just stop the interview there.
She pushed her wedding ring across the counter and said, "Tell me that it's worth more than I think." There's a bus to Baton Rouge, leaves in an hour, and $90 cash buys me a seat.
Let's start from the beginning, which is you coming out of Washington State, hearing Patsy Cline as a kid. Today, I read, at least, that this was the anniversary of Patsy Cline making her debut at the Grand Ole Opry. So I feel like it's very fitting that we're talking today.
Wow, I did not know that. And I pride myself in knowing a lot about Patsy Cline. Yeah, more than even anything I heard on the radio as a kid or in my parents' record collection, two things really shaped who I would become musically and just my taste: the movie Coal Miner's Daughter about Loretta Lynn and the movie Sweet Dreams about Patsy Cline. And those movies, I think, because not only did I hear their music, but I saw how it was made, especially in Coal Miner's Daughter, you know, with the scene where Loretta's working in the garden and writing Honky Tonk Girl. Before then, I didn't really know that people wrote songs. I just thought songs just always existed. And then with the movie Sweet Dreams, those songs that Patsy Cline recorded, to me, they're still some of my favorites. Crazy's my favorite song of all time, and just timeless. I saw that movie and thought, ooh, I'd love to sing and write songs like that.
Scratches on the back, and the B string tends to fall a little flat. But it ain't stolen.
Hey again, everybody. I'm Zach Lupitin. You're listening to The Show on the Road. This week, we take you through the tunnel of love and heartbreak with one of Nashville's supreme lady songsmiths, Brandi Clark. Now, Brandi and I come from very different places, but we were both basketball-obsessed kids who started playing guitar as a fun diversion and never thought the call to write songs from the heavens would take over our entire lives. Indeed, Brandi actually had a scholarship to play basketball in college. Like Brandi, I also fell in love with Patsy Cline growing up, hearing how she harnessed that ache deep within her, transforming true pain into joy and catharsis. Well, it's a gift that Brandi, like Patsy, has in spades. Can she write a devastating pop hook for Kacey Musgraves or Sheryl Crow or Miranda Lambert? Yes, she can do that too. But today, we finally get to dive into her amazing solo work, and I'm so glad I unearthed this talk from my fractured hard drive. Her songs are truly special, and I can't wait for you to hear them. Anyway, I'm so glad you could spend a little of your year with us. Please leave us a kind review on the podcast's page. And if you're in Denver on New Year's Eve, come see my crew Dust Bowl Revival. We're playing the Fillmore Auditorium. And don't forget to buy merch from your favorite bands this year. 20% off DustBowlRevival.com. Okay, enough of me going on and on. Here she is now, Brandi Clark. record, your life is a record. There's this embracing of the sad songs and their importance in life, and that they're necessary and they're the deeper moments of existence, maybe.
Well, yeah, I think it's where we can all connect. I think part of why people love Patsy Cline in particular is we've all felt that way, that ache, and her voice just lended itself to that, to telling that story. And, you know, I think it probably was a lot of her story. I think it's a lot of all of our story. And there's something we can connect on our sadness. We can connect on our happiness too, but I think in those songs, those sad songs, you feel a little less alone in that emotion, you know, because part of why you're sad is you, in those moments, you don't feel like anyone else feels the way you do. And maybe, you know, well, not maybe, the person you're in love with definitely doesn't. You know, usually they've left you or, you know, it's not worked out. And so to turn on a song like Patsy Cline, like She's Got You, you know, you're like, oh, I'm not the only woman who's lost their love, you know, and had to see somebody else have it.
That we used to share, and they still sound the same as when you were here. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got the records, she's got you.
The song that she debuted at the Opry was A Church, A Courtroom, and Goodbye.
Oh, you know. Good one.
And it almost is the entire arc of a tragedy happening in one song, you know, where you're seeing this person that you invested in and you loved, you know, legally cutting themselves off from you forever. And I read a little bit that your new record is sort of, you know, a breakup album in a way, but you didn't realize that until maybe it was already done.
I didn't realize it until the weekend before we started working on it. And I think it's because I was too close to it. And I had gone through the breakup of a very long relationship. And, you know, I'm always just writing. Every day, most days I'm writing. Not every day I'm finishing something. Not every day I'm writing something good. But I'm writing most days. And I'm just writing what's in the room on every day. And I just writing songs. And while I was going through that, writing songs. And before that, writing songs. Cause some of these songs are older. And when Jay Joyce, who produced the record, called me the weekend before, and he had been living with the songs, but he was the last person to live with them in the mix. You know, it was myself and the other writers, and then a label and management and everybody involved in the choosing of the songs. And he said to me, well, this is a breakup record. And I thought, wow, it is. You know, and I'm such an overthinker. Then I'm like, well, does Bigger Boat and Long Walk work in the thinking of this as a breakup record? He's like, oh yeah, we need those songs. You know, we need those songs. It's going to all work. But yeah, I didn't realize it till right before. And it, going in with that knowledge of, okay, this is a breakup record, it helped us shape the way the shape of the record, like where it began and where it ended in the middle and, you know, all those things, that I think make a complete project.
Let's go to that first opening track, because I'll Be the Sad Song again is this feeling for me of acceptance and maybe being able to have that bird's eye view of your own life, which is a very hard thing to do. And someone who's such a intuitive and emotive writer like yourself, I think has figured out a way to mine the pain that you went through. And, you know, over a decade long relationship, that's a marriage, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's a very hard thing to move through. And yet you were able to sort of, at least for me, to express in that song that it was worth it in its own way. Like the pain and the depth of feeling, it was worth it, because otherwise this song and the feeling that came from this song wouldn't exist.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I believe that grief is the price of love. You know, however much you love somebody is however much you're going to miss them. Whether it's the breakup of a relationship or you lose somebody to death, it's just however strong your love was is how deep your grief is going to be, but it's worth it. And you know, not just for the love part, not just for the highs, but for the lows, you know? I don't think we're meant to always be happy. I was just telling my nephew that we were told we should always be happy, you know, by society, but we're just not meant to always be happy. I mean, I think we're meant to have moments of joy and days of happiness, but we all have to go through different things. And I think that those valleys are as important as the peaks.
Some night when it's raining,
I had this conversation with my wife last night. I don't know if you've ever had those conversations with someone you're with in a relationship about the previous heartaches that you've gone through or exes, etc.
Oh, yes. Yes,
but
yes,
like,
yes.
But, like, you know, it doesn't always go well. But it's, I think, there's a point in a relationship where you can honestly talk to the person you love and say, yes, I loved this other person, and they broke my heart, or they ran out on me, they cheated on me, and I'm actually okay with that now. It's taken maybe 15 years, 10 years, but I, as an artist myself, as a songwriter, I am secretly grateful for that wellspring of pain that is easily accessed at any moment. Whereas before, when you were young, and you know nothing really had happened to you like that, you were faking it in a way. You know, and now it's like, you're not faking it. It was real.
That's a really good way to put it. You're just, yeah, you're faking it. Like all those high school relationships, which, I mean, some people meet and they're soulmate young and they stay together. And I don't want to discount that those relationships can't be meaningful. But most of us in those relationships, we're just practicing for the game, you know, that becomes our real adult relationships. And that's such a good point you just made.
My question for you also is, when you're in a relationship and people know that you're a writer, you've written for Kacey Musgraves and people who are all over the radio, are they afraid that something is going to be mined from these private moments and all of a sudden they're going to hear it on the radio?
You know, I don't think so. I could be wrong. I mean, I can't get inside everybody's psyche, but I don't think anybody I've ever been with has been worried about that. You know, my partner of 15 years that you know, was the big breakup on this album. I mean, I made sure and talked to her about it before it was recorded, before I talked about it being a breakup record, even more than before it was recorded. And she was great with it. And, you know, it's not all about that. There are co-writers on every song, so they have their input as well. Yeah, I hope I answered that right. But I usually don't, you know, sit around. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm hearing songs, don't get me wrong, and things that people say. But I'm not, like, laying in bed and thinking, tell me something I can put in a song. You know, tell me something really vulnerable that I can put in a song.
Yeah.
So I hope that answered that.
Well, yeah, you said, I think I read also that there is a limitation to, you know, autobiographical writing. There's a whole big tumultuous world out there that if you constantly are sketching your own face onto the pad, eventually you've seen all the angles, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that while this new record is maybe the most personal that you've done, there's big themes in here, you know? And, you know, you don't necessarily fit certain stereotypes of a major label country writer and singer, and when you've written songs for Miranda Lambert and folks that are maybe a little more in the mainstream, do the Music Row people in Nashville request that it's more heteronormative when the love songs come out? Because,
I get more flack, I feel like, from the gay community that my songs are too heteronormal.
Subtle.
Yeah, I try to write songs in a way, and when I feel like really great when this happens, I feel like I've really done my job. I try to write songs in a way that anybody could put themselves in it.
Right.
Whether it's a gay person, a straight person, a white person, a black person, like just anybody with a heartbeat could put themselves in it. That's always my goal. I don't always achieve that. And like I said, I just kind of write what's in the room. When you mentioned Miranda Lambert, I've had a couple things on her. I've had one hit on her. That wasn't set out to write a hit for Miranda Lambert. It was just writing that idea of Mama's Broken Heart that was in the room that day that was actually something that Shane McAnally, one of the co-writers, Casey Musgraves being the other, wanted to write about his sister and his mother. And so, I do my best work when I'm not really trying to do anything but tell a great story.
I screamed his name till the neighbors called the cops. I numb the pain at the expense of my liver. Don't know what I did next, all I know I couldn't stop. Word got around to the butterflies and the Baptist. My mama's phone started ringing off the hook. I can hear her now saying she ain't gonna have it. Don't matter how you feel, it only matters how you look. Go
in. The song that you wrote with Casey Musgraves that became sort of an accidental anthem for the gay rights movement, and it was played a lot, the Follow Your Arrow. How did that happen?
So that's a great example of something. That song, the life of that song is way bigger, than I ever dreamed it, and that I think any of us thought when it was written. It came out of, Casey, two things. She had written, the way I remember it was she had written a little... She had a friend that was, I think, moving to Europe for the summer or maybe for longer. It's been so long now, I don't totally remember. But she had written her a little note that said, kiss lots of boys and smoke lots of joints and follow your arrow. And I also remember her saying, they were at the tail end of making her first record, Same Trailer, Different Park. I also remember her saying that she wanted arrows in the artwork of her album. And so that's really where that started. And none of us thought of it as a gay anthem. It makes me proud that it is, and that, I've had so many people tell me how much that song means to them, and I'm just really happy that I got to be a part of it.
I think it's the choice, right? It's saying, make lots of noise, kiss lots of boys, or kiss lots of girls if that's what you're into.
Yeah.
It's not sort of forcing anything on people. It's just saying like, hey, we're all, as Bob Dylan says in his new record, we all contain multitudes,
Well, and at the time we wrote that song, we felt like the most controversial thing about it was smoke lots of joints. That was the point. Roll up a joint or don't. That's what it was. Roll up a joint or don't. We thought that was way more controversial than kiss lots of boys or kiss lots of girls if that's something you're into. So that's another example of it. It meant something different to the world than it did to us in the room.
Well, when a song like that wins, the Country Music Award, Best Song of the Year, that sort of signals a little bit that maybe the good old boys club of Nashville is opening its mind a little bit, but, you've experienced your share of disappointment with your own music not necessarily hitting the top of the charts like some of the people you've written for. And there's still constant disappointment that women are not more represented in country hit radio. You know, and why do you think that is so hard to change?
I don't know. I mean, if I had the answer to that question, I think a lot of women would be really happy. I don't know what the disconnect is, you know, and I've sort of given up on trying to figure that out for my own self and just find my audience. And not to say that I didn't and don't have supporters at country radio. I just didn't have enough on a big enough level to push a single through into being a bigger hit. But it's an equation I had to quit trying to figure out because it nearly drove me crazy and was not good for my creativity, you know, to worry about that sort of thing. All I can really worry about is the music I make and working as hard as I can to get it out there. I could lose years of sleep wondering why didn't they play me? Why don't they play this girl or that girl? I don't know.
I mean, someone like Dolly Parton, you know, in her early career is writing about abortion. She's mm-hmm. writing about divorce. She's writing about stuff that you would never think would be sung by a, you know, blonde ingenue singer. But she was doing it from a very young age. And I think you're covering some of that ground now.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've always thought of country music as truth-telling adult music. And, you know, some people call that now Americana. And that country has shifted into something different than that. But I think, you know, whatever it is, whether it's country, Americana, I think my stuff's going to always fall where the stories are being told. You know, and the darker stories. That's just not always. I can write a tongue-in-cheek thing very well too. But all of it has to have some truth to me. And you know, the truth is, if riding around in trucks and you know, if that was my truth, that's what I'd be writing. It's just not.
Well, you do come from a very small town. I mean, you're.
Oh, I've Morton, probably Washington. Ridden in more trucks than a lot of the people singing about it. Yeah. I mean, if we're being really honest.
So your town had, what, 1,000 people or so in it,
yes,
right?
Yes, it did.
And you were, you know, you started writing, you know, at a pretty young age, but you also were kind of a basketball star.
I was. I mean, for a small town, yeah, I was, you know, I was really good for where I was, and I was really dedicated to that. And I think it's a lot of why I've been able to stick with this music career. Is that I learned a lot of discipline at a really young age and self-discipline from sports. I played all sports. Basketball was really where I excelled. But I take a lot of that into what I do now, as you know, just as far as work ethic and teamwork and, you know, all that stuff factors in. I'm really fortunate I had that background.
Yeah, I'm glad that the little art school that I played basketball at in high school, I'm glad that we got our ass kicked like every night because our coach, for some reason, thought we should be in this you know, larger Chicago conference. And it was like deeply humiliating, but also like when we did win, it was so special. Like, you know, like we had somehow conquered like all our demons in one night, you know, because we finally had a chance to celebrate. Whereas every night we would take the, you know, the train home and just be like, man, I am so bad at everything.
Yeah. I mean, all of that, you know, it all turns us into who we are. I mean, we learn more from our losses than our wins. That's just the truth. And that's probably why, you know, we go back to what you were talking about with the sad songs. It's probably why some of us love those songs so much, because we've learned from those love gone wrongs more than we learn when it goes right. And they also teach us so that when it does go right, we can treat it better.
The song Who You Thought I Was off your new record has that peek into your maybe your childhood psyche where, you know, you're like, I wanted to be a cowboy and I wanted to be Elvis, right? Mm-hmm. Which is maybe not something most girls would say.
Well, see, that's a great, you know, you talk about heteronorms. That song was actually written for a guy. And right before I went in to record, I played it for my manager because there was just something tugging at me about that song. And so I played it for her and she said, I think you need to record that, but don't say cowgirl. You know, keep it the way it is. And I'm really glad that she said that, cuz it's a proud moment for me.
Before we get to the interview, I'd like to tell you that this week, the show on the road is brought to you by Wild. That's WYLD. It's a very cool Austin, Texas-based art gallery that exclusively features art from Native American creators. Are you having trouble figuring out a unique gift to give the unique people in your life this year for the holidays? If you go to wild.gallery like I did, you'll see they have an amazing array of original fine art, posters, and prints at all price points. And let me tell you, this stuff is legit. Some of the artists at Wild even have work in the permanent collections of museums like the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in D.C. Do yourself a favor and for once, actually support artists. Don't just get more mass-produced plastic pap on Amazon. Actually support living indigenous creators. Just go over to wild.gallery, that's WYLD.gallery, or call up Ray at the gallery in Austin to set up an in-person showing. Tell them Z from the Show on the Road podcast sent you. Okay, that's it for me. On to the show. Do you remember the first thing that you really wanted to be as a kid?
You know, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I do remember that. And that's my earliest. I remember, you know, when you do career day, in like first, second grade. And I wish I could find it, but there's a picture of me and I have this little stuffed dog and a stethoscope and a white coat on. I mean, thank God. I that would be too heartbreaking for me of a career. And I don't necessarily think I have the brains for it anyway, the science brain for that. But that's the first memory of something I wanted to be that I have.
What did your folks do?
So my dad worked in the timber industry. They both worked in the timber industry, actually. My dad was a logger. Like, he was actually killed in a logging accident when I was in my early 20s. And then my mom, she worked, you know, several part-time jobs, but when we were growing up, and then we got a little older and she went back to work full-time, and she was a human resource manager for a cedar fencing mill.
Do you think that you could have made it in the logging industry yourself?
I don't know. I mean, here's what I really believe about myself, and I don't mean this arrogantly. I think whatever I wanted to do, I would have figured out a way to do it. I'm not afraid to work hard. I feel like I'm pretty smart. I'm not the smartest person in any room, but smart enough to hold my own. And mostly it's that work ethic. I would have worked my way into whatever I wanted to do, and I actually did work at that cedar fencing mill that my mom worked at for a summer. And I realized in that, you know, I was sort of on the edge of not going back to school. And it made me like, okay, I know I don't want to do this, you know, is what I was thinking. What I love about what I do is every day is a little different. Even if I'm writing songs every day, sometimes I'm by myself, sometimes I'm co-writing, and it's never with the same person day after day after day, unless we're working on a specific project. But even that is never, you know, incredibly long. And so I like the diversity of what I get to do. And I learned from that mill job that I would not be good in something where I literally feel like I'm doing the same thing all day.
And your mom encouraged you pretty young to start writing songs, right? You started playing guitar at around, what, 10 years old?
I was 9, I think. Yeah, 9 or 10, somewhere in there. My mom's really musical. And so my dad always, you know, fostered the athletic side of me, and my mom fostered the musical side of me. And they both were supportive of both sides, but I had great parents, you know, just that's probably the biggest gift I've had in my life, and my parents. And but my mom, she could really help me a lot with music. Like when I was taking lessons, even though she didn't play guitar at the time, she could help me, you know, with reading music and time, you know, time and key signatures and those kinds of things. And I also saw her in her someone who could play full songs. So, you know, I wanted to be that and do that. So, yeah, she was probably, and still is, my biggest champion.
Yeah, and I watched that Tiny Desk show that you did, which is really beautiful. And you played some songs from your record, Big Day in a Small Town, including that song you, you know, kind of wrote for your dad, Since You've Gone to Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about seeing the camaraderie and the emotion that comes together in these small towns. You know, and your dad maybe wasn't famous or any sort of, you know, national hero, but for that small town, he was, in a way. You know, they had to fill the whole gym with people they couldn't even.
I was just talking about this on an earlier call, completely different project. But it's a musical that I've been working on. We were talking about small towns, and I used that example. Like, yeah, that says a lot. I mean, it says a lot about my dad, and it says a lot about the town I grew up in. You know, just people, you know, people care about each other there. And, you know, honk when they drive by your house. I remember when we would have, like, cousins from out of town, we'd be out in the yard, and people would honk when they would drive by, and I remember a cousin saying, "Why does everybody honk when they drive by here?" Well, it's because we all know each other, you know. And that song did, that song, Since You've Gone to Heaven, it was inspired by my dad's death. That's where it started. You know, it took years to write it, and it was something I ended up bringing into a co-writer. But my dad passed away, or I shouldn't say passed away, he was killed in an accident right before 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, I was still very raw in that grief. And then the whole world, or our whole country, was grieving. And I remember watching CNN and seeing the ticker tape go by. And I thought, man, since my dad has died, the world has gone to hell. And that's where that started. And one night I was driving to Tunica, driving back from Tunica, gambling with friend and collaborator Shane McAnally. We were just getting to know each other, really. And we started talking about how when a big figure in your family dies, it kind of blows the family apart. And so that's where it started. And we just wrote it. There's a little bit of both of us in there.
Signs in every storefront. Seems like everything's for sale. They say the market's bouncing back, but it's sure hard to tell. Since you've gone to heaven, you're rolling over in your grave.
Yeah, I remember my grandfather when he died in outside New York City. You know, he wasn't obviously a known figure in New York or beyond, but he just had this reputation of being a good, honest person that people could rely on. He was like the bedrock, you know, factory worker, always there for you type guy, you know. And just the people coming into that funeral home, like shaking, you know, the family's hands and giving condolences, just saying like how much they respected him and how much they, you know, admired him, you know. And it really showed sort of how being, you know, a honest and hardworking person is enough. Like, you don't have to be a star to have people love and respect you.
It's, you know, I think it's a lot more than we give it credit, just being a good person. And it's real simple, and I think it's real hard, you know? And I think it's probably harder than being, I mean, these days I feel like, you know, if you're willing to be shocking enough, you can be Insta-famous real quick, you know? And, I think it's, you know, I think the kids growing up right now, like I have my nephew with me right now from Alaska, and he's a really good kid who's being raised very differently. A lot because of my brother and sister-in-law, but also because of the part of the world he lives in. And, you know, he's on his phone, but not quite as much as a lot of other people, and especially people his age that have never not known of the Instagram world. And he's a good person, and I think it's, and I mean, I didn't mean to get off on him, but I've really been noticing that, and just how important that is, and how in this world we live in, I don't think we put a big enough spotlight on that, of just being a good person and doing the right thing and the kind thing.
On the other side of that, you know, growing up in a small town, did you feel like you always were a bit different, you know, being someone who maybe was a little more artistic and then not straight? You know, is that something that was hard being in a small town, or did people embrace you even when you were young?
Well, that's such a great question. I always felt like that I was a little different, and not different in a good way. I also want to say, I felt like there was something about me that just didn't quite fit in, even though I did, but sports were a way for me to fit in. And it probably was that I was gay and I just didn't know it, because that wasn't something I realized. I was a late bloomer in a lot of ways in life, and wasn't something I realized, because honestly, it wasn't a choice I even saw. And I don't, by saying choice, I don't want to, being gay for me was not a choice. I 100% was born the way I am, but I wasn't tapped into any of that. And so that probably had a lot to do with the part of me that felt like, man, I just don't know if I, even though I love this place so much, I do feel different. And then I think too, you know, my dreams were always things that were going to take me away from where I was from. You know, first dream being sports and basketball, and I got a scholarship and moved away and got really homesick and moved home. But then music was definitely going to take me away. There wasn't a big outlet for specifically the kind of music I was making where I was at.
Let's talk about some bad people now, because there's three songs that I want to dive into a little bit from each one of your records.
Okay.
That are, I think, are interrelated, whether or not you thought they would be or not.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with Long Walk, which is off the new one, and then Daughter, which is on the Big Day in a Small Town, and then Illegitimate Children, which I love, on your first record, 12 Stories. It's like the calling out of someone's bullshit.
Well,
and feeling like maybe that you're okay if a little revenge is taken out on them.
I've never thought about those three songs being related, but they really are. You know, I love that you brought up Long Walk. That's the first song I've put on a record that's a kiss off to not even a friend, but somebody that's talking about, in my mind, you know, what that song is to me is talking to somebody who's talking trash about me, you know, and judging me. I've never had a song like that personally where I'm talking to a mean girl, you know? And so I love that that's on there. Daughter, definitely, like talking to that guy. That song came out of, I was writing with Jesse Joe Dillon and Jeremy Spillman. And one of them was telling, it was Jesse Joe, was telling a story about a guy we knew and the way he was treating some girls at a bar. And, you know, there was, oh, I hope this happens to him, I hope that happens to him. And I said, I hope he has a daughter. You know, that will be the ultimate revenge. And then Illegitimate Children, that came, my co-writer Deanna Walker and I, we were talking, and she had been at a bachelorette party. And she was talking about all the girls that they were on when it was back when they had just started doing the tricycle taverns. I guess it's not tricycle taverns, but where people sit on the, you know what I'm talking about, dangerous things. And she was talking about, and so-and-so started making out with this guy she didn't even know and all this stuff. And I said, and this is how illegitimate children are born. And that's where that song came from. I mean, all of those came from very real places.
She's getting hammered on Alabama slammers. Three drinks ago, no, he wouldn't stand a chance. He's sipping whiskey, feeling confident and frisky. Right slow hand on a 20 and slips it to the band. By the end of the first verse, they're out on the floor. By the end of the song, they're out the door. Spirits are up, inhibitions are down. Same stories unfolding all over town. How illegitimate children are born.
You know, the realest for me was Long Walk, because it really was, you know, I've heard somebody was talking a little smack about me and felt, you know, oh. And I had, it was fresh in my mind, and then I saw where some artist was really being trashed on, and it really bothered me, and I wrote to the guy that had said it, you know, you need to take a long walk off a short pier. And when I said that, I thought, I better write that tomorrow or somebody else is going to. But both of those, they or all three of those came from real things.
You say in Long Walk, you know, also that I'm my mother's daughter. Did your mom also take no crap?
Totally. My mom's one of the nicest people that you will ever meet, but she knows how to stick up for herself. And, you know, I definitely got that from her.
Hello, glass house. On the corner of my street, dirty laundry out. For everyone to see, you're a middle-aged mean girl. Always throwing stones in that old Walmart lawn chair. High and mighty throne. Well, I'd give you grace, but why even bother? 'Cause after all, you can walk on water, so take a long walk off a real short pier. Take a center spot with you as a souvenir. I hope you sink like the shade of stones that you've been throwing. I hear it's cold as you at the bottom of the ocean.
What do you think you would tell yourself now? What would you tell your teenage self as you were starting to become a young woman?
You know, I would tell my teenage self to just be me. You know, to resist the urge to try to be anything else and to not waste time, not waste so much time on what I think other people think of me.
Yeah, because you're always comparing, and we do that now as adults, I think, with social media. We're always comparing ourselves against sort of the slightly bigger success that someone else has, or the bigger house that they have, or the cooler car that they have, or the record deal that they have.
Totally. I was talking to a friend of mine that battled bulimia and anorexia. I know this is completely off topic, but I think it also, you know, is relevant to what we're talking about. And she was talking to me about it one time, and I said, so did everybody just look fat to you? And she said, you know, Brandy, I only saw people who were thinner than me. And I think that's what happens to all of us, whatever it is. You're right. You only notice the people on social media that are this much more successful than you, or that are way more successful than you. You know, you don't notice all the people, like when you get something, you don't think about the people who didn't. You only think about who got more.
So when you started writing songs for other folks, you know, you had a breakout with writing a couple songs for Reba McEntire's record, All the Women I Am.
Yes.
Cry and The Day She Got Divorced. when you saw your songs being lifted into a much bigger realm where people were noticing, did that give you confidence to start trying to make your own music on a bigger scale?
You know, it really didn't, because all of that happened right at the same time. You know, I found out that Reba had cut those two songs and that I was going to get to make a record all in the same week. Is my dog, can you hear that?
It's all right. It's charming.
Okay. I don't know what's going on, but she wants to be heard on here. Anyway, so I had worked for so long and just was really kind of beginning to think, oh, maybe nothing's going to happen. I mean, it didn't keep me from working, but this, like I said, the same week that those two songs got recorded by Reba, and I had had a lot of things before that. They just fell off records, or they were failed singles on other artists. And for me, everything started to really happen all at once. You know, so that was, it was surreal.
Is there an artist right now that you wish you could write for or tour with?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, I feel pretty lucky I get to write with a lot of artists that really inspire me. And as far as touring, oh man.
Maybe someone we wouldn't think would pair with you, but would pair perfectly.
That's such a good question. You know, I've always wanted to tour with a legend like James Taylor. Mm. You know, I'd love to go out in front of somebody like that. That would be a real dream for me. You know, I this guy, you wouldn't necessarily think, but Billy Joel, because he's such a songwriter. I feel like his crowd would like what I do.
Yeah. Well, you did record Bigger Boat with a legend.
Yes, Randy Newman, yes.
I would like to see that little run.
That'd be if he's now that'd be out there. I don't know if he is or not, but that'd be an amazing show. It'd be an amazing show to be a part of.
But that that back and forth, there's the part where you say, we're on the Titanic, but we think it's the Ark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was writing with him. Or did he just sang on your song?
He just sang. I wrote that with Adam Wright, who's an amazing writer. Randy did change a line. We had The Shit's Been Hitting the Fan a little closer to home. And he changed it to Give Me That Hammer, Somebody Hold My Coat. But he didn't want writer's credit. It was really sweet. He said, you know, I'm not one of those rappers that needs writer's credit. Part of me kind of wished he would have, just so Adam and I could have said that we wrote a song with Randy Newman. But he was fantastic to work with, just all the way around, a pro. And one of those guys that, you know, they always say, like, oh, don't meet your heroes. He was pretty cool to meet.
Funny, when I was on Spotify looking through your stuff, for some reason it recommended at the end of your record, you will also like this album, Disney Hits in Indonesia.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, why would that be the case? But maybe because Randy Newman writes for Toy Story, but I was like, that makes no sense. But it was, and I started listening to these Indonesian Disney songs, and it was pretty amazing.
That's crazy. I would have never, ever known that. I guess anything paired with Disney is good. Disney's a great brand to be associated with. I would never think of my music as fitting in with Disney.
All right, top Disney film. Go. Don't even think about it.
Lady and the Tramp.
Ooh. Controversial.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the Disney classics, honestly. Little Mermaid's pretty good, too.
I think my first musical reckoning was the soundtrack to Jungle Book.
Great one.
That my parents had to stop me from singing I Want to Be Like You with the, you know, the orangutan trying to learn how to make fire. Like, they're like, can you please stop singing that over and over again? For the love of God.
That's amazing.
What is your biggest fear right now in your life?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think my biggest fear is that we're not going to figure this virus out, and that it's going to keep us in this state of semi-lockdown. My fear is that it's going to be like a wave at a football stadium. And from the start, and I'm not running this country, so, you know, of course it's easy for me to say how I would run it. I have thought, why don't they just shut us all down for a month? Like, really shut us down in ways that I would hate, you know? But why don't they do that and then it'll go away? If it doesn't have a host, all it would take is one person coming in to infect us all. But I fear that it's going to stay. All the states are going to be in different levels of lockdown, and it's just going to go on like this, not until the end of this year, but for years. And I don't like the virtual world. I do my best with it, with Zoom calls and Zoom rights, but I don't enjoy not being able to touch people and sit down and have a meal with somebody and, you know, hug somebody. I don't enjoy that. And I don't know what that does to us long-term as a society. I worry about that.
Is there a time where you felt that music saved you? And what was that song? Is there a song that lifts you up whenever you really, really need to be lifted up?
You know, I would say that music really saved me in my early 20s. And not that those were bad years, but I was figuring myself out. And I was also I had played basketball and all sports, but, you know, I went to college on a basketball scholarship to begin with. And when I stopped playing, I really didn't know who I was. I really had all my identity wrapped up in that. And then I shifted to music. And during the time when I was grappling with, okay, who am I now if I'm not that person that's this good athlete, music saved me and took the place of the passion I had in the other area. So, and I can't say that it was one song. It was a lot of amazing records at that time, and just diving into music. That would be a time when it really, really, really held me up.
The last song I want to talk about is the final track of your new record, "The Past Is Past," and I think it comes back around to the feeling of acceptance and trying to be okay with the heartache and the realization that there's no turning back, you know, and that some things aren't meant to last, and that's okay. Because in the moment, that's really hard to process, but you, I think, are able to process things in such a beautiful and nuanced way. And I'd love to know a little bit more about that song.
Well, I wrote that song with Barry Dean and Luke Laird. And I remember the writing of that song feeling really amazing. And we did a little demo right just in Luke's office that day. Like, he can play a lot of things and is a great producer as well as a great songwriter. And, you know, it felt good. But it wasn't until I sent it to the A&R people I work with at Warner that I realized, oh wow, this is really something. Because that was when they had been listening to a lot of my songs and loving a lot of songs, but that was when they were like, I think it's time to make a record. And so that song, it's interesting you would bring it up, being the last song on the record, that was kind of the centerpiece of the record for a long time. And it was what, you know, it was what the catalyst for what goes around this, you know, and that song being chosen is a huge part of, I think, why the album took on the nature of a breakup album. And so when I was making the record, we recorded that song first, And I mean, we went in, we did a pre-production today to see if the players that Jay was thinking would work for this album and what we were going for would work. We did that song. And we worked on it all day and loved what we had, and then took a break and came back and made the record. And as it was going on, Jay and I were talking, and I said, wouldn't it be something to start this album with I'll Be the Sad Song? And I was a little nervous to say it. Like, my heart started beating fast because it's a ballad. And I was afraid he might be like, what, are you kidding me? That's crazy, starting a song with a ballad. And he's like, oh, I like that. He said, and then we could end it with Past is the Past. And I loved that idea. And so when we turned the record into the label, we sequenced it that way. And they wanted to flip them. They wanted Past is the Past first and I'll Be the Sad Song last. And when I get to that point, I listen to different voices because I'm so close to everything I don't know. But that was something I felt so strongly about. Like, that was the hill I was going to die on. And I said, no, it has to be. I mean, I respect you guys, and I know you want what's best for me in this record, but it has to be the last, it has to be the other way. Past is the Past needs to finish this record. And they said, why? And I said, because I'll Be the Sad Song is sad. It ends with, you'll always be that song to me. And I love it because it's sad. And I said, Past is the Past is bittersweet. It's sad too, but you close on hope. And I think that's why that song resonates with me, because there is a hope in it. It is like, okay, we're closing this chapter and I'm driving away and you won't be in my tomorrow morning, but you were here and you mattered. And I know I matter to you, but that chapter's closed. And so I think that's why not only that the song was important for the album, but the placement of it was important.
This is where the past is the past, where the meant to be's ain't meant to last, where the maybe we can work it out turns into maybe we can't. This is where the memories we missed start catching dust in a picture frame, where the hope turns to know that there ain't no going back. This is where the past.
All right, last impossible question. You're stranded on an island, and you only have 5 albums throughout history to bring with you for the rest of your life. What are those 5 albums?
Great question. Patti Loveless' When Fallen Angels Fly, Patsy Cline's Greatest Hits, George Strait's Box Set, Tapestry, Carole King. I think I need something to bring me up at this point. This is going to seem out of left field, but I think probably, maybe Jimmy Buffett's Greatest Hits.
Hey,
or Elton
not?
John. You know, I love a good Elton John record. But at that point, those are pretty heavy records. I need something to lighten it up.
We need the light with the darkness. Well, I'm glad we could talk in this strange time. I'm waving to you across the freeway right now.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
I don't think you're going to play us a song, right? Or do you want to present a song?
I have. It's pre-recorded.
Okay.
And that it'll get sent over with this interview.
Which song is it?
Bigger Boat.
And you got Randy Newman just hanging out in Agora Hills.
No,
right now,
it's
right?
Just me. I sang the whole. I did it. You know, I just did it without him.
I mean, what could Randy be doing right now?
Well, you know, he's probably writing songs, honestly.
Yeah. That's what he does.
Yes.
We're either all the way left or all the way right. The only time we meet in the middle is to fight. The rich get richer. Rest get a little more broke. We're gonna need bigger. Floods down south, fires out west, you turn on
Well, there she goes, Miss Brandi Clark, everybody. You can go to brandiclarkmusic.com for her newest. It's called Your Life is a Record, and the deluxe version came out this year. Same Devil, featuring Brandi Carlile, is also out now. So many tasty brandies, so little time. I apologize to Brandi and her fans for not putting this out sooner. I had a crazy computer and hard drive meltdown last year, and I just got this back. So thankfully, I was able to get this talk into the world before it was too late. If you want to check out the other cool podcasts on the Bluegrass Situation Network, you can check out The String, where Craig Havenhurst talked to Brandi back in June 2020. And if you go on the Bluegrass Situation on March 5th, you'll see that there was an article written about Lindsey Buckingham's song with Brandi Clark. She really teams with all the coolest people. Check that out, thebluegrasssituation.com. If you haven't supported your favorite bands and artists for Black Friday, Cyber Monday, however you call it, you can still do it, folks. 20% off dustbowlrevival.com. We have t-shirts and CDs and vinyl, all sorts of cool stuff you can bring home. Instead of funding more billionaire space travel, you can fund your favorite band to fly to Phoenix, where we're playing tonight at MIM, Musical Instrument Museum, Saturday night. We'll be back home at the Troubadour in LA, and then finally, December 31st, New Year's Eve, finishing off 2021, playing the Fillmore Auditorium with Railroad Earth in Denver. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lubitin, associate producer Taylor Kaufman, and we are a part of the BGS Podcast Network. Stay safe, get vaccinated, and we'll see you on the trail. Sharks in the water got me thinking about a movie quote. We're gonna need a bigger boat.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.